You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Jay tricked me. So as you know, Jay Yao is the producer of this podcast. And we were just talking casually and he asked me about all the different things. I've been obsessed with a lot of different things ever since I was a little kid. And kind of this power of obsession has driven my entire life, for better or for worse. Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. And we're just casually talking about it. And then I realized he's recording. And so we made an episode about the power of obsession. And you kind of hear in the beginning, I didn't really want to do an episode on it. But then I realized, oh, this has been an interesting thing for me. And this aspect, this power of obsession, has overall very positively affected my life. So here we go, the power of obsession.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
You know what's really interesting yesterday when you go on that guy's David Shen's show?
Yeah.
That I never really thought about is that the power of obsessions. Right, the power of obsession is because you were so obsessed with so many different things, one at a time, that you have all this interesting adventure kick you into a quest.
Yeah, like for instance, I mentioned how when I was 6 years old, I was obsessed with Greek mythology. I've never read a book on Greek mythology since I was 6 years old, but I remember everything because obsession helps the memory too.
Yeah, wait, so I'm just curious, 6 years old.
Yeah.
When do you start reading?
I don't know, when I was three or four.
As far as you can remember.
Three or
four, oh my God. And then you already start reading like Greek mythology and stuff like that.
Yeah, I had to get a special library card to take books out of the adult section.
How? I'm just curious. I'm just totally curious, right? Like, I don't know if this is going to make it into the podcast or whatever. But I'm just curious. How does 6 years old, you look at something and you're like, I'm going to obsess with this Greek mythology. Like, what? Like, do you remember the start of it?
Well, I didn't decide to be obsessed. It seemed like comic books, but better, because these were stories of that had lasted for hundreds or even thousands of years about these gods. So it was almost like they were real. I didn't know. I was 6 years old. I didn't really understand what religion was at a deeper level. You know, how, you know, religion is designed to basically control the population in various ways. And, you know, I'm not saying faith is bad. Like, faith could be a good thing about religion, and religion could be very powerful in a positive way. But often in many historical periods, religion was used to control the masses. I'm essentially quoting Karl Marx here. But the stories are beautiful. Like, it's like Joseph Campbell's, you know, The Hero's Journey. Like, every one of these mythologies all have a creation story. They have like a god that rules all the other gods. Sometimes they get angry. Sometimes they fall in love. Sometimes they, and they all have like superpowers because they're better than mortals. And there's amazing stories that are supposed to, you know, teach people truths of life. And that's kind of how, you know, information would get transmitted from one generation to the next. Like, oh, why does the sun go down at night and come up in the morning. Well, there's a god named Apollo who rides a chariot who, you know, brings the sun around the world every single day. So, and so that's how this, that was like science then. And so this, that's how this science gets passed down from one generation to the next. And, you know, their battles, for instance, again, in Greek mythology, Aphrodite, who was supposedly the most beautiful goddess, you know, Zeus, the king of the gods, wanted her to be married. So he wanted to award Hephaestus. So Hephaestus was a god who basically made all the weapons of the other gods. So he was like a, he was like the god of blacksmiths and weaponry, but he was very ugly. He was hideous. And Zeus wanted to award or reward Hephaestus for all the good he had done all the other gods by making all of their weapons. Like he made Zeus's lightning bolts, for instance. And so he married Aphrodite to Hephaestus. But meanwhile, Aphrodite was attracted to Ares, the god of war.
Right.
And Hephaestus found out, and Hephaestus was a big guy, and Ares, the god of war, was ironically a coward. And so so just the little lesson there is that often the most warmongering people are cowardly at heart. So it's kind of a moral lesson there. But anyway, Aphrodite and Ares started having this affair. Hephaestus found out, beat the living crap out of Ares. Ares complained to Zeus, and Zeus had to punish Hephaestus. So he threw Hephaestus down to earth for a year, and he had to live like a human for a year. And imagine then, that leads to many stories. Like imagine you could write a novel now. What happened to Hephaestus the year he was a normal human? So
right.
So like there's all sorts of stories, and that's why you have all these stories even now written. Like all these young adult novels are about the Greek gods, on like the children of the Greek gods that are on Earth right now. And you know what's that called? The
Percy Jackson.
Yeah, Percy Jackson. Right. Is like some child of Poseidon, the god of the ocean, or something like that.
Right. So he essentially he's a Titans, right? That's what they call the Titans, or demigod.
Oh yeah. So the Titans, and again, all of this is from books I read when I was 6 years old. I haven't read a single book about Greek mythology since I was 6 years old, but I was obsessed. So I read everything I could find. So the Titans are kind of like the aunts, uncles, and parents of the gods that ended up being the real Greek gods. So there was a god, Cronus, the head Titan, the oldest Titan, was named Cronus, and he was the ruler of all the gods. And there was a prophecy told to him that one of his children was going to kill him and become the king of the gods. So every time his wife had a child, he ate the baby. And,
oh my God.
And one time, the mother, I forgot what her name was, his wife or whatever, she got sick of, "You're eating all my babies." So she took, when she was giving birth this one time, the last time, she quickly, the midwife, she gave the baby to the midwife. The midwife, you know, hid the baby. This was the baby called Zeus. And instead, she made like a fake baby, like out of rock. And Cronus ate that baby instead of Zeus. So Zeus grows up, and the mom's like, "Hey, get your brothers and sisters back." And so Zeus kills Cronus, his father, and, you know, gets his brothers. Their brothers and sisters are still alive. They're just in Cronus's stomach. So he gets all his brothers and sisters back. And then Zeus becomes the king of the gods, and all his brothers and sisters, like Poseidon and Hephaestus.
I didn't know he has a sister.
Oh yeah, Zeus. Yeah, I think Demeter is his sister. I mean, I think he married his sister. Forgot what her name is. See,
tons
I don't.
Of
I don't.
Incest going on.
Hmm? Yeah, exactly.
Tons of incest going on.
And then he had children too. So like Hermes is his child.
Right.
Athena. So Athena was his child. She was born from his brain. So that's why she's like the wisest of the gods.
Yeah, she's supposed to be the goddess of wisdom, right? Or something like that?
And Apollo and Artemis are his children. Yeah. And they're like twins. So Artemis is the moon. Apollo's the sun.
He's the sun.
And Artemis is sort of the first example of lesbians in kind of mythological history. And she was also the goddess of the hunt. And
no, I didn't know that.
So a lot of these gods also are similar in other countries. So like, you know, the equivalent of Zeus in Norway is sort of like a combination between Odin and Thor. And the equivalent of Hermes in Norse mythology would be Loki. And so there's kind of like little comparisons and throughout all of these different religions. But I was obsessed. So I would read all about Greek mythology, Egyptian mythology, Norse mythology, Hindu mythology. So I would, and then again, this is all when I was six, I would trade my Superman comic books with my friends who were from India, who had like these comic books called Amar Chitra Katha. And so it would be like all the Hindu gods. So the Mahabharata would be in there, the Bhagavad Gita, but just in comic book form. And so I would read about all the Hindu gods in these very popular comic books in India. And so
6 years old, that's crazy. Also, I don't mean to like break the flow, but I have one conspiracy theory about all this mythology.
Tell me.
I think Greek mythology, essentially, it's alien.
Right? Oh, yeah. Why do you think
about it, right?
So you're saying Greek mythology and probably all these mythologies are Asian. So why do you think that?
Oh, no, Asian. Not Asian. Alien.
Alien. Oh, because of the idea that the aliens possibly cloned an alien and left a human here on Earth, but they're like the gods.
Right.
They're what we think of as the gods. Like who built the pyramids? Well, there were a bunch of gods around. You know, it's an interesting fact that we're closer in time to Cleopatra than Cleopatra is to the making of the pyramids. So the pyramids are so far back. We just really have no idea how they were made, who made them. I mean, what do we discover that like each block in the pyramids is 2 tons and comes from, you know, 100 miles away from where the pyramids are? Like, how do they carry them there?
Yeah. And also the Sphinx, right? I don't know if you heard about this. The Sphinx, if you look at it, the human's head, it's it's not proportionate. So what happened is maybe before it was actually way larger, and then they cut it down and become and make it into like a human head, you know. Like if you think about the Greek mythology and stuff like that, right? You have a blacksmith that make Zeus weapon, like a thunder weapon, thunder, like magic, sort of sci-fi if you think about it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, mythology was kind of like the science fiction of those times. And by the way, some of these religions still exist, like Hinduism still exists. And you could argue the Bible is a form of mythology. You know, for instance, why does Christianity have angels and saints? Well, it's because Roman mythology had all these gods and they wanted to convince the Roman Empire to not persecute Christians. So they kind of said, oh, we're similar to Roman gods. It's just like, you know, here's the angel Michael and the angel Gabriel, and they have different powers. And there was a war between the good gods and the bad gods, you know, just like in Roman mythology. And, you know, it's all
related.
Yeah, it's all related because, you know, and really probably the source of a lot of religions, like the reason why is Hinduism, there's a god of the sun, there's a god of wisdom, there's a god of this, a god of that. And they're all kind of represented in Greek mythology. A lot of theory is that Alexander the Great, when he was invading all these different countries all the way down to India, he kind of brought Greek mythology with him. So, you know, in India, kind of the regular gods sort of were more northern India, where Alexander the Great was conquering. And more southern India, at least at that time, this is like in 400 BC, southern India was more like Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu. It's almost like two different mythologies, but they work together. But Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva were much more powerful than like the regular gods. So Indra, who was the king of the gods in Hinduism, is more like Zeus. and Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva are more like this trinity of gods that are much more powerful.
Right. That's like, isn't Shiva is like the god of destruction or something like that?
Yeah. So Brahma basically created the universe. So like, Brahma is almost like this equivalent to God in some sense. Really, God is like all three combined, but Vishnu preserves the universe. He keeps it going. And Shiva is going to destroy the universe eventually. And Shiva is all about change. And so then it gets very deep. Like Shiva is about change and creativity and so on. And Vishnu is about, is very, very wise. And Vishnu would, much like the story of Jesus, Vishnu would go in human form occasionally. These were called avatars. So like Krishna is an example of an avatar of Vishnu. And like when the world needs some big thing to happen to change it, Vishnu turns into a human and goes down to earth.
Gotcha. So it's a lot more philosophical that way.
Yeah, but just like Christianity, Greek mythology is also very very philosophical. Like the story of Prometheus. So the story of Prometheus he could see the future. He was a Titan and he could see the future. Right. And he told his brother, listen, so his brother's name was Epimetheus. And again, I'm just remembering this from when I was 6 years old.
6 years old.
But Epimetheus had a special power. He could see the past. He knows everything about the past. But Prometheus had a better power, which he knows everything about the future. So Prometheus said to Epimetheus, listen, this Titan thing seems like a great deal right now, but it's not going to work out for the Titans. So just let's hide for a little bit. So when Zeus killed all the Titans, Prometheus and Epimetheus kind of took off and did their own thing. But Prometheus eventually, he was very sympathetic to humans. He liked humans. He thought humans would eventually rule the earth, instead of just being like another animal. And so he wanted to give them a special present. And so he gave them fire. He taught them how to use fire. And when Zeus, and he also taught them what it was like to eat food from that the gods would eat. So the humans wanted to show their new special talents to the gods. And so they cooked a meal using fire and using food from Mount Olympus where the gods live. They cooked a meal for Zeus and the other main gods. And Zeus was like, what the hell? Where did you learn about this fire stuff? We didn't teach you this. And they were like, well, Prometheus taught us. So Zeus punished Prometheus. He tied Prometheus to a mountain, and all day long, a vulture comes to Prometheus and eats his heart out. And then at night, the heart, because Prometheus is immortal, at night, the heart regrows. And then in the morning, the vulture comes again and eats his heart out. And that's for the rest of Prometheus's days.
So basically, the gods want to oppress human. And right. Then Prometheus
But there's a deeper point too, which is that, there's that saying, don't play with fire. Like, God, it's too powerful. Don't forget, humans are the first species. There's like millions of species on Earth, right? But humans are the first and only species that can, with a single stick, can destroy an entire forest. So they made technology. That's like fire is like the first scalable technology in that, if an elephant can't burn down the whole forest, like an elephant has to kind of like knock down one tree at a time and kill one animal at a time. They just have to, they have to go find something to stomp on, and they stomp on it and then it's gone. It's not scalable, but humans made the first scalable tool, which is basically a stick of fire. Cause with that, you could burn down a whole forest and kill everything in it with just like a single stick of fire. So it was very dangerous. And so you have to be very careful how you use fire, both symbolically, what fire, dangerous things and fire itself. So it was really kind of like a moral lesson that, Zeus is basically saying, don't try to get too powerful, which is why, like even Oppenheimer, when he made the nuclear bomb, which is much more scalable than fire. What was that expression he said?
what's it about the chain reactions, right?
No, now I become Death, the destroyer of worlds. That's what he said the first time they exploded an atomic bomb as an experiment to see if it would work. He said, now I am become Death, the destroyer of worlds. And I believe he's quoting Krishna from the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, of course, is Vishnu. So again, there's all sorts of like deeper moral lessons. But anyway, that was, you're talking about the power of obsession.
Yeah.
What obsession does is it makes you over and over and over again think about the same thing. And so when we're growing, basically most of this happens from the ages of 6 to like 25, which is why they theorize maybe memory starts to decline after, you know, starting from your early to mid 30s. What did I say? Memory starts to decline. And it's because when you think about something over and over again, okay, you have these connections between neurons. I think they're, what are they called? Synapses or whatever. But what this other substance called myelin forms around the connections that you form between the neurons. So it turns like a road into a superhighway so that information can go back and forth much faster. And so the things that you really remember well, when you obsess on something, you build more and more myelin around these synapses. And so that's why obsession greatly, greatly increases your memory. Now, when you get older, people used to think you had no more myelin left to build these strong connections after the age of 25. That's not true anymore. That neuroplasticity, the ability to kind of grow your brain, still continues. It's just not as powerful. So when you're obsessed with something now, it's harder to form memories around it. But when you're a kid and you don't have a lot of memories yet, you have all this myelin that kind of, that's why you know, what you're exposed to when you're young is very important. So I'll tell you, like when I was 6, I was obsessed with mythology and also obsessed with the New Testament, which as a Jewish person didn't make me, the parents didn't want their kids to hang out with me. Because I was talking about Jesus all the time to my Jewish friends. So I literally, like, parents would call my mom and say, get your dirty son away from my kid. And, you know, everybody dislikes everyone else. That's what you realize. But
isn't New Testament is sort of mythology as well, right? So that's why
it's the Old Testament.
Yeah, so it's still fall under the whole mythology, like Greek mythology and type of like the category, right?
That's yeah, because if you think about it, yes, one thing about Judeo-Christian Islam religions is there's only one God, right? It's a supposedly a monotheistic religion. But if you look at the personality of God between the Old Testament and the New Testament, it's very different. I mean, God in the Old Testament punishes people and gets angry at people, right? So Moses allowed for idols to be created when he didn't allow this, but it happened. He didn't manage his team well, and when he was off getting the Ten Commandments, they built the golden calf or something,
golden plate. But from what I know from Monty Python, it was supposed to be 15 commandments, right? And then he dropped one plate and became 10 commandments.
Yeah, right. So he comes down from Mount Sinai and all the Hebrews had created this golden calf like to worship. And so Moses did drop the first version of the 10 commandments. He had to go back up the mountain and get second version. But as his punishment, God was really pissed off. And God said, you know, you're going to get to Israel. You'll see it, but you're never going to enter it. And that was his punishment. And God also, you know, was a little upset at humans during the time of Noah. So he said to Noah, listen, I'm going to keep you and your family alive and all the animals, but the rest of these humans can go to hell for all I care. So, and that's when he flooded the world and there was Noah's Ark.
Right.
By the way, there's similar floods in other religions like Hinduism and Greek mythology and so on. Right. And so...
And also, didn't he kill like someone's son? Was it Aaron or Isaac's sons?
Yeah. So Abraham had a nephew, Lot. Mm. And he didn't... he didn't kill Lot, but he killed Lot's wife because they were hanging out in Sodom and Gomorrah. And so, and when he told Abraham, look, get them out of there because I'm going to burn those places to the ground. They're so disgusting. I'm going to burn them down. And Lot's wife, and God said specifically, when you're leaving Sodom and Gomorrah, do not look back. And Lot's wife was curious what was happening, and maybe she missed a little bit of that Sodom and Gomorrah partying that she was doing. She looks back, and she instantly turned into a pillar of salt and died. And so, so in the Old Testament, not always, but some of it, he was maybe a little bit of an angrier God. And in the New Testament, Jesus has more of a message of love, and right. God sort of changes. So it's, there's not, God doesn't have like one personality, like, you know, Adam and Eve, story of Adam and Eve. Yes, God created these great things and gave them great things in the Garden of Eden. But when they broke the rules, he punished them. When Cain and Abel, when Cain killed Abel, he punished Cain. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't punish in the New Testament. There's the Christianity believes in the notion of sin, but you know, it's, God has different personalities in the Bible depending on where you're reading. And so anyway, but it's just like how all these gods around that time, you know, the Old Testament is based on stories that happen in 2000 BC, 1500 BC, and like, you know, from 1000 BC to like 400 BC. There's like these different sections. And so it's written over a long period of time, and there are different writers for different sections that, you know, we don't know for sure, but that's the likely theory. And so God's personality changes throughout. And it's interesting studying these things almost from a literary perspective. Whether you believe in religion or not, it doesn't matter. Even if you believe in it, it's interesting to study these the different parts of the Bible from a literary point of view, like how people wrote the way they wrote back then and how they told stories and so on. But anyway. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, I, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
So the power of, we're talking about the power of obsessions, right? So you remember all this because of your obsessions with the mythology and the Old Testament, New Testament. I'm just talking about one part of your obsessions, right? Because you have a tons of other obsessions.
Yeah, that was like just one year.
And all that stuff.
If you name me but, any year between the age of 6 and the age of 55, I could tell you my obsession. And right, sometimes 12. They lasted a year. Sometimes they lasted more than one year. It just depends.
All right. Age 12.
Age 12, I was obsessed with politics. So here's... And I didn't know the issues. Like, you're only 12 years old. I don't know. So I was 12 in 1980. So in the 1980, it was Jimmy Carter, who was the president at that time, versus Ronald Reagan. And of course, Ronald Reagan won, and Jimmy Carter was a one-term president. And I didn't know anything about the issues. I didn't know what Reagan stood for. I didn't know what Jimmy Carter stood for. I didn't care. I was just interested in the game-like aspects of politics, like, what is an election? What do people have to do to win an election? What are all these personalities like? You know, it was just fascinating to me. Oh, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. Like, all these conspiracies. But when I say I was obsessed, like, I got the list of... So I called up the Federal Elections Commission, and I got the list. It was a printout of all the people who were running for president. And that's when I realized... There's more than just the people you see in debates running for president. There are hundreds of people running for president. Like, if you go to ballotpedia.com right now, you can see all the people who are running for president for 2024, including my name on there, because it only takes a few minutes to start running. But so then what I would do is I would skip school. Like, I would basically, I would leave for the school. Okay. And then I would go into my backyard and hide, like, basically next to the chimney or whatever. And I would wait until I heard the garage door open twice. So both my parents went off to work. And then I'd go back into the house and I would spend the whole day calling up presidential candidates and interviewing them. And if you
search... Do they actually pick up?
Huh?
Do they actually pick up?
Well, I would call their office and I would say, oh, I'm writing for... this local newspaper, can I interview you? And I will. And this local newspaper did pay me at one point to publish the interviews. If you search South Brunswick Central Post and James Altucher, you'll see me as a 12-year-old and all my interviews. So I interviewed all these presidential candidates. I interviewed the minority leader of the House, who later became the Speaker of the House. I interviewed the chief usher of the White House. He's like the chief butler of the White House. His name was Rex Scouten. And on my birthday, Rex Scouten, who later became the official historian of the White House, Rex Scouten invited me and my dad on my birthday to come have like a private tour of the White House that he gave us. And so we went like to all the private areas of the White House on this tour. And I went to the Democratic National Convention that year and hung out on the convention floor. It was in New York City, so it was easy for me to get to. And I flew to Mississippi because Jimmy Carter, even though he was president, he had two people who were trying to fight him in the primaries. Joe Biden has nobody fighting him in the primaries, really, because RFK right. Jr. became an independent. But Teddy Kennedy was fighting Jimmy Carter in the primaries. And also this one unknown guy, Clifford Finch, who was the governor of Mississippi, was up against Jimmy Carter. And of course, he lost disastrously. But I flew to Mississippi. Clifford Finch's campaign paid for it. And I stayed with his campaign manager. I flew to Mississippi for a week to interview him. I was 12 years old. And he made me an honorary colonel of Mississippi. And they all got a kick out of this 12-year-old, like, being obsessed with... I was giving him advice on how he should campaign and how he should make speeches and everything. And I was trying to like come up with speech ideas for him. And
wait, did they actually take some of the idea or did they just like, oh, this is good? And then they just like,
yeah, I think they leave. Just said, oh, this is good. And you know, he was nice for doing that. I think maybe he thought my dad was rich or something, which my dad most certainly was not. And I think they thought they were just going to raise money from my dad if they treated me nice. And so,
right.
But, you know, all you know, it was interesting. I had a lot of adventures, put it that way. Like you always want to have obsessions that lead to adventures. And so when I was 12, I was a little more mobile than when I was 6, not that much more, but a little more. But I was just obsessed with politics. It's what I would do all day long. Like I would think about it in school or I would skip school. And I was constantly calling up, like I interviewed Senator Bill Bradley. I interviewed tons of senators, congressmen, mayors, you know, all sorts of politicians. And I would tell my parents I wasn't doing any of this stuff. And then they get the phone bill. And people who are old enough will remember, phone bills were, it was really expensive to call outside of your town. Like if you made a right. long distance call, which was anywhere, like could be just a few miles away, you start getting charged. And just think, inflation's up about 5 times since then. So like a dollar then is like $5 now. So my parents would get these phone bills of $600 a month. So that's like $3,000 a month in today's dollars. But like salaries were like, I don't know, my parents made like $40,000, you know, they made like nothing. And I was costing $3,000 a month just on my phone bills. So they would just be screaming at me all the time. And I said, I promise I'll stop. I promise I'll stop. And I was just not able to stop.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Wait, so, and again, like anything I know about politics and presidential history, most of it comes from that year. Like I read every biography of every president. I read about all the big elections, you know, that were infamous, like 1876 or 1824 with John Quincy Adams, or of course, George Washington and John Adams and Aaron Burr. And then all the way up to like Roosevelt versus Hoover. And just, I was, you know, there was this guy, Theodore White, who wrote really great election books. They're not really popular now, but they were the election books about 1960, 1964, 1968. And then Hunter S. Thompson, it's the first time, I was 12 years old, the first time I read Hunter S. Thompson. He wrote a book, mm-hmm. Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail in 1972, really crazy book. So I just read tons of stuff about politics, but more from like an election and personality point of view. I didn't know anything about issues at all.
You know what amazed me the most is like you're 12 years old and your parents are like, yeah, just go to Mississippi by yourself.
That was the first time I ever flew in a plane. And I was, and I couldn't believe it. Like I get out of the plane and I'm like, wow, this is a different, it looks the same, but it's different. It's like Mississippi.
But just you alone, right? Not your parents with you.
Right. And then I was hanging out in the campaign headquarters every day. And, you know, everything's different now. Everything's more blended. But I remember one guy said to me, I never met a Jew before. And this is no offense to anybody. This doesn't happen in Mississippi anymore. I've been to Mississippi since and it's, you know, like every other state. And then another guy said, oh, what's your initials? And I said, J-A. And he's like, jackass. And like, they were just, they
12
were just
years
different.
Old.
So, but I didn't mind. And then I would hang out with the governor all day talking about his campaign.
All right. What about 18 years old? We jump 6 years ahead.
18 years old, chess.
You started chess at 18.
I started at 17, but it continued. 18, I was New Jersey junior chess champion. And I mean, I was obsessed with it. It's what I did all day. Again, I would skip class and skip school, and I'd go into the Manhattan Chess Club. But every day, like 10 hours a day, that's how I got good at chess. Was just a lot of kids start young. So I had to catch up, and I started basically when I was 17. And by the time I was 18, I was the strongest, you know, junior or kid in the state. And, you know, I wish I had either started younger or kept going. Like my problem is I would just get obsessed with something for a year or two and then I'd move on. And do something else. But chess was a good obsession for me. My parents were really worried because before that, I was obsessed with breakdancing. Like all I was interested in was being a good breakdancer.
Wait, how old were you?
I was like 15 and I had gone to this exchange program where I got to go to London for a summer and I completely skipped all the activities of the program that I was in. And I hung out in, I guess, what would be considered kind of like a ghetto. And I paid this other kid like $20 to show me how to breakdance. And like, so for the whole summer, I hung out with these kids who were just breakdancing all the time. And so I got obsessed even when I got back to the US, and that's all I would do was practice. And I'd watch, there were just a couple movies. One was called Breakin', another was called Beat Street. And, you know, occasionally there was some breakdancing on MTV, but I was just obsessed with it. And that's all I would do.
Well, let me ask
you. But my parents did not like this obsession. They thought it was not a good obsession for me.
I mean, you're Jewish, so. Have you seen any other Jewish breakdancing?
They just didn't know. They were thinking, like many parents, they were thinking, well, what's going to get this guy into college? And right. It's probably not breakdancing. So they were much happier with chess.
If you're good at breakdancing right now, I'm pretty sure you can get into any college.
That's probably true. It's unique enough. And it's also, it wasn't really considered like an art form then. And now it's,
right.
It really is a beautiful style of dance, which combines so many other styles. You know, this is why hip hop and breakdancing has really flourished. I mean, these guys, you know, a lot of musicians in that space make hundreds of millions of dollars. Probably the only area of music as popular as hip hop is, you know, like country western.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Save big money at Menards. Keep your lawn looking its best with Menards' premium four-part fertilizer program. Each step is tailor-made for the health of your lawn. Get started this spring with a bag of crabgrass preventer with lawn food. Apply just once early in the spring to feed your lawn for over 2 months. Pick it up in our garden center today and check out Menards.com for more hot deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Okay, so let me ask you this. The power of obsessions.
By the way, this is why when I was older and starting my first business, I did all the websites of all the rap labels, and I did the website for the Source magazine, which is like the premier magazine in the space, because I knew all this stuff. I knew everything.
See, that I was about to ask you that. Did any of the obsessions lead into anything later in life? Like, let's say the first one, the mythologist, right? I assume it will lead into your writing.
Yeah, like... When you are essentially, when you're interested in mythology, you become a student of storytelling because you notice how all the stories are the same with little twists. And, you know, like I read the Bible like front to back just because I loved it. Not because I was religious or had a faith or anything. I just loved the stories. I read all about Greek mythology because I loved the stories. And, you know, I think I got interested in it because I remember one time there was a Superboy comic book that had Apollo in it. And then there were comic books like Thor, and there were comic books like Shazam, which referenced the Greek gods, and Thor was the Norse god. And then, of course, I got those Indian comics. And so it was all like linked to me. Like, I loved comic books too. So, and that's kind of like an American mythology in some sense. And the art of storytelling is all intertwined with mythology. A myth is a story. And, you know, in politics, there was just 1 year where I was really obsessed with it. But ever after, I know a lot about what happens in elections in the US. And so each time there's an election, I kind of have a running start knowing what is going on behind the scenes. Like,
right, but at the same time, you also like interview, so you interview people, you interview the politician before. So like that's also sort of just start of sort of interviewing podcasting type of thing, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would all day long be calling people and interviewing. But my interview, you know, I had the interview style of a 12-year-old. Oh, do you like being a senator? you know, for Bill Bradley, did you also like, what do you like more, being a senator or a basketball player? And, you know, I didn't ask anything about issues. I had no concept of issues. That was above my head. So, and even now, but I guess what it gave me was, is that I still don't really believe in issues. I got such a sense back then that it was a game and you won by playing the game with a good strategy. So I never trust any politician on what they claim are their issues. Now, that's unfair to politicians. I think some politicians really do care about their issues, but I think most are ruled more by ambition than a care of issues. And by that, I mean, they'll not always, but in part, take on an issue if it polls well. And the one time, so I think it was 2014, I wanted to run for Congress. And there was a major presidential candidate who wanted to support me. And I remember him saying, though, that I had to hire his pollster so I could see what issues I should talk about that are popular in the district. And I said, I had my own issues already. I don't need a pollster. But that really underlined the thing that I kind of intuitively grasped when I was 12 years old. It turned out to be really true that the pollsters are the ones who tell you what issues, you know, a pollster is someone who takes polls. They're the ones who tell you what issues to talk about. And look, it's part of the game. So I still think of politics as all a giant game.
I mean, it is, right? Because like how often the policy actually change?
Yeah. Like it doesn't change that often. And not only that, look, they all know what to say in their speeches, and then they make these promises, and they rarely follow up on the promises. So, like, for instance, I'll just take a quick example, because on another meeting I was on today, we were talking about marijuana stocks, and Joe Biden said he was going to make marijuana legal as the first thing he did as president. Of course, he never talked about it again. So, nor has he really changed immigration policy or anything. So, very few things get changed from president to president. That's another thing I realized. But it was fascinating. Like, you know, again, back when I was 12, we had, you know, just 6 years earlier, Richard Nixon had resigned in like the biggest scandal in presidential history, you know, except for maybe Warren G. Harding and the Teapot Dome scandal that we all know about. And again, all this stuff is, I only remember these things from when I was 12, but that's when you're building memories. So and you build memories the best as a young person by being obsessed with something. It's very hard to be great at something you're not obsessed with. And the reason is obsession is not about love. It's not about passion. It's about you're so interested in something, you'll do it even if you're not passionate about it, even if you're not motivated. That is the thing about obsession. Obsession is mostly unhealthy. It's like addiction. You don't want to do heroin every day if you're a heroin addict, because eventually, you know, the road of a heroin addict is not a pleasant road in the long run, and everyone knows that. But you do it anyway because you're addicted. And so with me, I had this weirdly addictive personality, not to drugs or anything, but to these ideas and aspects of life, like, you know, mythology or politics. Or, you know, when I was 13, 14, I got obsessed with like the occult. So I wanted to get psychic powers, because then maybe I could use my mental powers to get, you know, I was entering puberty. I wanted to have girls like me. And so maybe my psychic powers could make me more attractive. And, but then that led to an obsession with meditation. And so like by the time I was 15 or 14, I was really into meditation and got obsessed with it and would meditate like for hours a day. And I knew all the different styles of meditation, from Vipassana to Zen to, you know, compassion style Tibetan meditation to more American style, you know, mindfulness and so on. So I learned every style of meditation. And that helped me in later in life, because then when I, you know, I kind of have this, you know, back, you know, this way of meditating that I developed myself along the years, and it's very useful for me.
So let me ask you this. I don't know if you can answer it or not, because I felt like it's in your bone. It's in your DNA. How to be obsessed with anything?
How to be? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's why I don't know if you can answer it. Yeah. Because I felt like you have the switch in your brain that it just switch on and off automatically. You can't even control it, I felt like.
I think mostly it's an escape. So for instance, why did I start playing chess again? Well, in August 2020, as all my listeners by this point know, I wrote this article that had like a lot, millions of people loved it, but my friends and family basically dropped me after this article. And then all the people I knew in New York City, you know, hated me. And I got a little depressed after Seinfeld wrote his full page op-ed against me. And it kind of, I don't know, subconsciously, it did something. Like, I stopped writing for a while. Well, whenever I had a period like that in my life before, I would just start playing chess until the writing came back. And then the TV show The Queen's Gambit came out, and suddenly everybody was interested in chess, and I was already a chess master, so I became obsessed again with it. And when one obsession begins, another obsession ends. So I stopped doing stand-up comedy, which I was obsessed with for years before that.
Well, yeah. So like what makes you obsessed? Were you escaping something that you were obsessed with stand-up comedy?
No, I think that was, okay, escape I think happens about half the time, and aspirational happens the other time, meaning I always really admired people who went up on stage and told jokes. Like, I thought it was an incredibly brave thing to do. And I enjoyed public speaking, and I was very funny all the time when I gave a talk. So people would always tell me, oh, you should be a comedian. And so I tried it once. This one comedy club owner said, hey, do you want to just try going up once? And I said yes, and I was scared to death, and I was horrible, horrible, horrible. But I became so obsessed with getting good. A, I bought half that comedy club from that guy, and I've since resold it back to him. I started performing every single night. And for hours every day, I would watch comedy specials to learn, oh, what makes Dave Chappelle great? What makes Chris Rock great? What makes Louis C.K. great? And I've watched the specials of hundreds of comedians. And because I owned a comedy club, I watched thousands of comedians over the years, and, you know, most of them very bad. So I think that helped me get pretty good pretty quickly. I'm not going to say I was great, because I think it takes a really long time to be great at it, but I was good enough that I can, you know, I would travel around to other cities, even other countries. I was touring with Tony Woods, who was Dave Chappelle's mentor. So he was a good mentor to me as well in comedy, but I was obsessed. I mean, that's why for a period my podcast was like all comedians, and we had a dip in audience because of that. Now I'm not making the same mistake now. We've hardly had any chess players on.
Yeah. Well, so
and but comedy, that obsession helped me in many ways. Like, it helped me, first off, my public speaking, which was already pretty good, got 10 times better. And there are so many skills in comedy that are useful for public speaking, but the regular public speaker does not have these skills. So you have to be a comedian to kind of acquire the skills, but it became so useful for my public speaking. It like 10x'd my public speaking. And also, it was the first time I owned a physical location, like a bar/stage when I owned the comedy club. And so that is useful to expand my understanding of business, something I never was obsessed. I never was obsessed with business, but I'm good at it. But, you know, you could be good at things you're not obsessed with, but, you know, I'm not the greatest. I'm not like the, you know, Warren Buffett of business. Like, I'm not anywhere close, because I never was truly obsessed with business. I just know a lot about business because of, you know, 25 years experience running businesses. But
right.
So all these things do contribute to my life.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So your obsessions became a quest. And the quest that leads to adventures.
Yeah.
And like, that lead to like interesting stories.
Yeah. The first time I went up on stage at a comedy club, who would know that just a few years later, for instance, as an example, I would be traveled to every major city in the Netherlands performing comedy, like actually right before the week before COVID, or that I would have all these experiences with all these comedians. Like, I would know all these like well-known famous comedians who were my heroes. And ultimately culminating in Jerry Seinfeld trashing me. And And so I think that was part of the reason why I dropped comedy also, is like, I felt like that world betrayed me a little bit.
Oh man, you got betrayed.
Yeah.
Your heart got betrayed.
My heart was
whatever
broken.
Your heart was broken by the things that you loved. And then when you're 12 years old, you got crowned as honorary, I can't say the words, the colonel.
Yeah, an honorary colonel in Mississippi. I became an honorary lieutenant colonel in Alabama, and that's a different story. But many years later, in like 2006, I wrote about becoming a colonel in all these states, honorary colonel in all these states. But I said the one state that would not give me an honorary colonelship was Kentucky. So like Kentucky Fried Chicken is Colonel Sanders. He never was in the army. He was an honorary colonel of Kentucky. Colonel Muhammad Ali, an honorary colonel of Kentucky. Elvis Presley, an honorary colonel of Kentucky. It's really hard to be an honorary colonel of Kentucky. So the governor of Kentucky in 2005 read my article and made me an honorary colonel of Kentucky. So now I'm an honorary colonel of Kentucky.
So basically, I'm working for a colonel. Do I get a title myself if I work for a colonel?
Maybe I can make you a lieutenant colonel.
Can I?
Well, we got to start you off at private.
Private?
Private, I mean, yeah. Then you got to get... Well, okay. You've done well. Maybe you're up to like lieutenant now. Not lieutenant colonel. So lieutenant. By the way, there was one point I was obsessed with the military. Like maybe when I was... like 7 or 8, because I was watching, like, for listeners who lived in the US in the 70s, all the shows were like military shows. Like there was, I Dream of Jeannie was basically about an astronaut / major in the Air Force. And F Troop was about a bunch of people in a fort in the 1800s, and they were all military. And there was a whole bunch of like shows that had a kind of like a military aspect to it. So I got obsessed with like the military for a short period.
Right. But I mean, no matter what rank you give me, I have no idea, because I have no idea the rank of military. I don't know if lieutenant is higher than captain or...
No, it goes... it goes second lieutenant, captain, major, lieutenant colonel, brigadier general, lieutenant general, major general, and... 4-star general. And then a 5-star general, someone like Eisenhower, who like commands all the generals when he was in the military.
Why can't they just consolidate them a little bit? Like there's too many titles, too many rank.
I think they have a system to it. I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, and you know, the Navy has similar titles, but instead of generals, there are admirals. And so there's a method to the madness.
So this is all to say, like, the power of obsession is actually very powerful, that leads you to like adventures, leads you to like skills that you probably will need.
Yeah, every obsession I've had has led to some benefits in my life. Now, some regrets though of that is I wish maybe I had stuck with some of the obsessions for longer than I did. But the good thing about obsession is you could do something for a very short amount of time, and if you're obsessed, you'll quickly be among the best. You might not be the best, but you'll be in the top 1% of what you're obsessed with. So like, I got obsessed with computer programming when I was in college, but I was already 3/4 of the way through college or 2/3 of the way through college, and I had never taken a computer science class in my life, but I got obsessed with programming. So I switched my major in the last year to computer science. I'd never taken a course in it. And I took 6 courses a semester and also over the summer, computer science, just to catch up. And then I graduated a year early, majored in computer science, then went to grad school for computer science. Because I was so obsessed, I was able to catch up. You're able to catch up much faster with the power of obsession, which happened to me in chess too. I didn't start till I was 17. So other kids would start when they're 4 years old or whatever. So, but now you asked an important question, which I've been thinking about a little more as we're talking, which is how do you get obsessed with something? And I think the key is you got to read a lot, and you got to try a lot of things. So reading gives you ideas of what else is out there, but doing makes you get that dopamine. And, you know, I would get dopamine, an explosion of dopamine, for instance, if I was interviewing, a presidential candidate or a senator or whatever. Or, you know, I would get dopamine when I'd win a game of chess. But like an enormous, like an outlier amount, like too much. So that would give me this obsession. But you have to actually do things to see how your body feels about it. And that's how you get obsessed. If the body feels good, you'll do it more and more. So that's why some people get obsessed / addicted to drugs. Some people get obsessed / like I loved the flow state I would get into when I was programming a computer. And I essentially put in my 10,000 hours very quickly. I would love the flow state I would get into when writing. So when I got obsessed with writing, and usually there's some reason, like this girl I had a crush on liked a guy who was a writer. And so I said to myself, I'm going to be a writer. And then I started writing. But then I got obsessed. And I would read instead of going to classes, I would go to the library and just read like literary criticism and read books. And then I would go home and write. I'd write 3,000 or 4,000 words a day for years and years and years, like for 20 years, basically. I mean, the obsessive part probably lasted 5 years, but then I was simply good at it and still getting better because I was writing for money then. And I kept doing it.
Cool.
So I would say the way you get obsessed is leave yourself open to it. Like expose yourself to a lot of different things. And that could be through reading or watching or whatever. And then actually doing those things. So like having an experience, it's one thing to watch a lot of comedy. It's another thing to go up on stage and do comedy. Now, it's fine if you're obsessed with watching comedy and being like a critic, say, or a reviewer of comedians or an interviewer of comedians. That's fine, too. It's a different kind of obsession. I was obsessed with doing it. I was obsessed with doing meditation or interviewing politicians or, you know, I didn't really do anything with Greek mythology. Like I didn't learn Greek or anything, but I was 6 years old, so all I could do was read and talk about it. And I would drive my parents crazy because here I was, a six-year-old kid. We'd go to like visit other families, you know, like families do. We'd get together with my parents' friends and they would have kids. And my parents would always have to warn me, like on the car ride over, don't talk about Zeus to the other six-year-olds there.
I mean, I wish you would talk. I mean, I love mythology stuff. I wish you have. I wish I would have known you since then, but then I would be too old right now. So,
yeah. Well, we could talk about Zeus now, but it's not as interesting. But yeah, so I think obsession is important, and no matter what it is you're obsessed with, unless it's like a drug like heroin, it will benefit your life in some way. Like you will learn things that will be so deeply ingrained in you, you won't even know. Like just because I don't do comedy now doesn't mean. Like every single time I give a public talk or in many other cases, there are skills you learn from that you're able to apply that you don't even realize you're applying. Or even the stuff I learned when I was 6 or 12 or 15 or 17 or, you know, even I'm sure there's things even from breakdancing that I still apply today in life.
So that's the episodes for today. I think these are great episodes.
Good. A good interview, Jay. You were a good interviewer.
Thank you.
The power of obsession.
Thank you.
We'll keep this in the recording because I'm going to analyze this podcast. I didn't realize we were kind of getting into a podcast, so I feel like my voice was low energy in the very beginning. But in the intro, we'll do after we finish this episode, I'll explain that.
But that's more real though. Like we want the real James. We want real, like look at the reality TV. Everyone just wants something real right now.
Yeah, but reality TV is, so there was a period where I was obsessed with pitching a reality TV show.
Holy shit.
Reality TV is scripted. Some people know that, but many people don't know that.
Yeah, it's just like WWE, right? Or WWF, the wrestling.
It's like, okay, you know, we were on a meeting earlier for talking to a potential the big advertiser for the podcast, and I mentioned the TV show House Hunters. So if you don't know what House Hunters is, I'll just describe real quickly. It's the most popular TV show in the world. 25 million people a month watch it, and it's syndicated in like 50 different countries. It's on HDTV. It's basically a couple. Here's the format. A couple looks at an expensive house, a cheap house, and a house in the middle, and they decide what house to buy. So That's the whole format. That's the whole description. It's this, and my TV agent like 6 years ago explained to me this show, and he was trying to convince me that to do simple formats, and I got the point. But the whole thing is that the way I describe it, it makes it seem like, oh, first they're going to look at this expensive house that they never saw before. Then they're going to look at this cheap house that they never saw before. Then this middle cost house that they've never seen before. And then they're going to make a decision all within the chronology of the show. But even a show like that is scripted because it is a real couple, but the house that they choose at the end, they had already bought that house when they were in escrow. They were already in escrow on the house when the producers of the show picked them to be on the show. So they had already decided, but they hadn't yet closed the acquisition yet. So the old people were still living in the house. So, but they were in escrow to buy the house. So they had already decided, but then the show makes it seem like they decide later. And by the way, the expensive house, they had already looked at it and rejected it. The cheap house, they had already looked at it and rejected it. And the producers would take a look at all the houses they bought and figure out all the houses they looked at and figure out which one should be the expensive one and the cheap one. So even such a simple format like that is somewhat scripted.
So basically all the house hunter actor.
They're real people who are buying a house. In fact, they already bought the house that they supposedly decide to buy on the show. But yeah. they're not actors, like they don't know how to act, but there's an element of storytelling. It's not reality. Let's put it that way. It is definitely not. There are no reality shows that are actually about reality.
Gotcha. All right. So that's the power of obsessions.
Yes. And look, cool. I got obsessed with investing, and that changed my life forever because I got obsessed with, you know, you see a lot of people working in the investing industry. They know about trading stocks or trading metals or real estate investing. But because I was obsessed, I had to read and do almost every style of investing: day trading, arbitrage, value investing, growth investing, real estate, private investing, venture capital investing, quantitative investing, everything. And I was just obsessed. That's what I did for years and years. So that obsession, of course, has changed my life completely.
Yeah.
But anyway, all right, Jay, you're doing a good job of trying to wind down this podcast. I just keep going because I'm obsessed with all the things I've been obsessed with. And I have so many stories, but we could do this again another time. You know, pick different years and I'll have different obsessions. And
I think that should be the series.
Yeah.
We're just like 1988. What's your obsessions? And then just tell, you know, the whole story about your obsessions.
1988 was entrepreneurship. And I first got interested in being an entrepreneur in 1988. And I started a weird kind of food delivery company, kind of like Uber Eats. Actually, I started. We had 10 restaurants. No, we had like 20 restaurants. And if somebody ordered through our business, they would get a big discount. I arranged that with each restaurant, and then I would take all the orders. And there was a guy on the football team at Cornell, Fred, and he was like an 1800 rated chess player. I was, you know, close to 2200. And we would play chess in between orders, and then we were the delivery people as well. But I had to program. I didn't know anything about programming. I had to program the software for all this. And so I went from being obsessed with entrepreneurship for the first time, and that's how my computer science obsession started.
James is supposed to wind down the episode.
I know, but you said a year. I had to tell you the obsession.
That was supposed to be the series.
Don't say any years anymore.
I mentioned the year because that was the year that I was born. So.
Oh, well, that was a defining year in my life, was the year you were born. Because you were born, exactly. Not because of the entrepreneurship stuff. So the power of obsession. Thank you very much, Jay, for getting me going. I didn't even think we were doing a podcast and you were secretly recording, which is nasty. And a drastic invasion of my privacy. But this is the episode.
We'll be right back.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Save big money at Menards. Keep your lawn looking its best with Menards' premium four-part fertilizer program. Each step is tailor-made for the health of your lawn. Get started this spring with a bag of crabgrass preventer with lawn food. Apply just once early in the spring to feed your lawn for over 2 months. Pick it up in our garden center today and check out Menards.com for more hot deals happening now. Save big money.